So, what I'm going to try and do is just a quick outline of the experiment. A bit about this, because this, what I'm talking about here is an experiment's in progress. So I'm going to talk about the doing of an experiment more than I'm going to talk about the experiment, except that actually, because of some things that we've decided to do as we've gone along, we now actually have some very significant data, and what we're demonstrating actually is the importance of learning as the experiment goes on in terms of changing practice. And so, and particularly Molly's going to talk about that at the end. But there's an obvious context. There is massive pressure on criminal justice budgets. And we forget sometimes, we talk about the 20% in policing, but it's 20% in the Crime Prosecution Service. There's courts closing all over the place. There's pressure on the probation budgets. Everybody is having to think hard about what they do with what they've got. And if you think that spreading the jam evenly as it diminishes on a rather smaller piece of toast is going to be an effective strategy, it isn't. It simply produces cracks. Now, I'm not going to pursue that metaphor any further. But there is an important part of the government's agenda which is focused on a renewed emphasis on prevention. It's timely given the challenge. And what are we trying to do with this experiment? As you'll see as I go through the detail of it, what we're trying to do is to trigger two pieces of criminological theory and make them work together. The first being deterrence. Deterrence, which theorises that offenders' perceptions of risk are affected in particular parts of the activity of offending and potentially rule-breaking, and that actually what particularly the theory would suggest is that if the response is quick, celerity, and certain, and is clearly related to the offending behaviour, that is likely to be more effective than a prolonged process of response. That's one key part, and there's good evidence to support that from things like Operation Hope, which is a probation approach which has picked up and adopted those strategies. And secondly, a considerable amount, a growing amount of research on the factors that help to encourage desistance. Every offender, bar a very, very tiny minority, will desist at some point. The question is, can we encourage people, reduce the disinhibitors and increase the supportive and encouraging things that will help people out of offending? And given that I always like to compete, I've got an even better formula than Daniel. This is incidentally from Daniel Nagin's work on deterrence, and I have no intention of explaining it. It's merely there for illustration, but to show you what an incredible amount of statistics support my thesis. And it is, after all, still 2:45. So what are we trying to do? What we're trying to do is we're taking a sample of offenders, a very carefully constructed sample of offenders, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the ethics of this experimentation, because, as far as I'm aware, this is the first randomised control trial in which the process of prosecution has been the turning point of the experiment. Very rare is it to randomise the prosecution process. So we're taking low-risk offenders. Because we haven't got the triage tool as yet, we've defined low-risk offenders by being, you know, very careful and cautious. No prior convictions, or only one prior conviction more than 5 years ago, and 2 years ago for juvenile. And the offence not likely to result in an instant prison sentence. We're saying our definition of harm for the purposes of this experiment is made up of the offender's prior behaviour and their character, and the offending behaviour that they've committed. And what we'll show you what we're doing in a moment to try and triage that out. And then developing a standard protocol of tactics for police offender managers in order to hold a deferred prosecution over the offenders who go into treatment. So essentially this is a deferred prosecution experiment rather than a standard diversion experiment, because we're not doing nothing with these people. So that's a wonderful Chief Constable's double negative. And in fact, we did demonstrate incidentally that custody officers don't like double negatives, just as a matter of interest. So we go through a set of decision-making pathways. First of which is the first and most important double test that has to apply in English law is there has to be here a sufficiency of evidence to prosecute. So that's the first thing. You have to have a case to prosecute. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to defer prosecution, you need to be able to return to it and prosecute it successfully. There's no point in holding a sword of Damocles over someone whom the CPS are discontinuing the prosecution. The second part of the test is it in the public interest to prosecute this person? Why is that important? Well, because what we don't want to do in this experiment is to net widen and expand that the net to include a load of people we would otherwise have cautioned and diverted anyway. So we're being very careful to make sure that we don't make that net bigger and get a load of quite nice, easy cases that would probably result in low levels of offending. We want the people who the custody officer has decided they are going to prosecute. Then we exclude sensitive cases. So, for example, you're excluding homicide, you're excluding knife carrying, you're excluding sexual offences with under 18s. There's a range of cases that come out. And they come out because, as you'll see in a sec, the custody officer goes into a little tool, the Cambridge Gateway, and they tick through the boxes, and the computer says yes or no. Likely sentence, you might ask, well, how do the custody officers know that? Well, they've been trained in the sentencing guidelines as part of the training. And how do we check that? Well, we got the CPS to go across 25 cases and check whether they felt the cases would have resulted in a prison sentence or not. And bar a couple of cases where I think the CPS were wrong, and as I was a member of the Sentencing Guidelines Council, I was right. Okay, I think we are pretty well agreed that the custody officers are actually very good at judging whether someone's likely to get a prison sentence or not. We do a final safety check. We've left a question in question 14 on the randomizer, and that says, is there any other reason why you wouldn't put this person in the thing? And there are one or two that where the custody officers said, no way, I'm not happy to put this person in. And finally, we come on to the victim's wishes, but I'm going to pause that because I'm going to leave Molly to deal with the victim's wishes at the end. And this is the gateway. Essentially, it's a little Internet Explorer tool that sits behind the custody system. Once the custody officer's decided that they are going to prosecute, they switch into the tool and they enter the data. That allows us to do several things, but one really critical one is it allows us to keep a constant check on the internal validity of the experiment. For those of you that have been through the training on the validity of experiments, it is crucial to know that because this is going to take us 12 months to gather the data, it is crucial to know that in the process of the experiment, as few variables as possible have moved. Otherwise, you're not measuring the same things as you go through. And therefore, the gateway is designed to do that. And the second thing it's designed to allow us to do, or two or three things, first of which, it will do the yes treatment and control, so it'll do the randomization process, and therefore you're taking away a human agent making that judgment. It's entirely computer based. But also, because of the questions, we can also do some very careful block randomization. We can differentiate between adults and juveniles. We can differentiate between a range of other factors as we go through the process. What happens to these people? So the computer has said yes, they're in the turning point plan. They've been arrested, and there are two absolutely essential parts to the process that happens then. The first one of which is they get told that they are likely to be prosecuted if they don't do the next bit. So prosecution is held over them for between 4 and 6 months. And then there is a conversation. The aim is to have that conversation as quickly as possible. And the normal practice is to have it around about 10 o'clock the following day, or if it turns out to meet, possibly the same day, but usually the following day, or in the afternoon if they're a juvenile. And that's simply a matter of the mechanics of the way of offices work and people are available, and making sure that the people are always available when the appointments are made, which has proved to be, there are some mechanical issues here which have proved to be quite challenging in the first few months. The conversation is a conversation that is fundamentally linked to the type of training that offender managers have had, and in fact one of the things we discovered was they hadn't had that much training, and that's been put right as part of the process, and the training in pathways to crime, so back to the previous conversation. And then, just to emphasise, this is voluntary participation. The offender can elect to be prosecuted if they wish to. Well, it's not quite that voluntary, but there's a carrot and a stick involved in this process. The carrot at the end of the day is they won't get a criminal record. The stick is, once you've decided to embark on this process and you've agreed the turning point plan, compliance means no prosecution, non-compliance means prosecution, and non-compliance means non-compliance with any of the key conditions that you've said you're going to do, and the conditions and whether you re-offend or not. And One of the tests of that was, were we confident that the PNC would find them if they were offending in another force area? And it's interesting, we are reasonably comfortable because we've had a couple of hits. What we're doing on the PNC is to flag these offenders, and we've already had one offender who breached in Thames Valley and was picked up. So we're reasonably comfortable that cases are being picked up. Well, it's never perfect, but it's reasonably comfortable on that. Now, just a quick trot through some of the issues that have emerged in putting this piece of research together. This is a pipeline randomised trial. We're not switching a batch system on a given day. This is going to take time. There is a pipeline of offences coming into this, and that pipeline is quite small, and there's a very specific reason for it being quite small. We decided very early on with West Midlands Police that given all the other stuff that's going on and all the other challenges in policing, this had to fit inside normal policing. Therefore, we had to do this at a pace that normal policing could cope with within normal. And incidentally, that's a plus for the future, because if it's capable of being coped with inside normal policing, it's capable of being replicated in other forces. If this is a specialist squad doing stuff which has been invented for a purpose, it becomes much more difficult to persuade its general rollout. So we've been very careful about that. And obviously, I'm an unusual researcher. I've been on the other end of those exciting opportunities to replicate something, and I've known how difficult it is to do. So I've been very careful to do this in a way that could be done anywhere else and relatively quickly. That kind of sets up some of the questions I'm now going to answer. These are questions that Larry posed in an article in the Handbook of Quantitative Criminology, and it takes you through. It's an exceptionally good article. I'm going to make him blush on that, but it is an exceptionally good article because it takes you through the challenges of doing one of these. And the first part of that is negotiating this relationship between the researchers and the force. Alex has described part of it, but it's a complicated process. A complicated process because it's not just a process of negotiating the relationship with the ACPO team. It's not just a process of negotiating that relationship with Alex. It's a process of negotiating that relationship right the way down the line through into custody suites. And people actually looking researchers in the eye and feeling confident that when they are told that actually this might work, or indeed will work, which is, you have to be careful with the language here, that they feel comfortable. So, for example, when you see one of the case studies, would you be comfortable to say to one of your colleagues, this will work, and will you sit down after you've just been assaulted by an offender and go through restorative justice with the offender that has just assaulted you whilst you were on duty? Would you be prepared to do that? One of the custody officers, and I quote, said, the professors, and I think he meant me as one of those, the professors told us that this would work, and he persuaded his colleague to do it. And that is was a breakthrough moment, I think, in terms of the experiment. Committed management is crucial, and we've put a lot more effort as we've rolled it. We're now rolling it more widely in Birmingham. We've put a lot more effort into a very much more structured approach with management right up front. We relied on our kind of two or three folk in the early stages to spread the experiment with colleagues, but actually we've learnt from that. We need to do much more to assist management, not just to understand the experiment, but to have picked all the bones out and therefore have the answers when people are approaching them with questions. We need a funders network. We need serious stakeholders at a senior level as back cover, and we've got the chief executive of the CPS, for example, Jim Barker-McArdle from ACPO. We have a range of folk who are giving us advice, pointing out the holes in this process. We did what you must do in this occasion, and you can find it on the internet, is we published the protocol ahead. So given this is quite controversial territory, not the least of which it is not particularly popular with magistrates, and therefore it is quite important to be quite open about what we're doing, not quite open, very open about what we're doing and how we're measuring it. I think the biggest learning from me, and I worked with Larry on the restorative justice experiments in Thames Valley, quite apart from many other pieces of research that were done when I was a chief and then obviously leading the National Policing Improvement Agency, but even I did not appreciate until I came to be the researcher and be involved in the practice of this particular experiment, how much this is a process of learning and change. And I'll just place a little more emphasis when I just talk you through the phases in a sec. The vital nature of that gateway is crucial. And we've had all sorts of challenges with it, not the least of which is making the language work for custody officers. And I think, again, lesson number one is you have to test it and test it and keep testing it and never assume that the questions in the gateway mean to everybody what you think they mean. And that is not, incidentally, a criticism of custody officers. It's mostly a criticism of my ability to draft questions. We are measuring at the end of the day what we're comparing with those who are prosecuted versus those who go through Turning Point is the outcome in terms of their frequency of committing crime and the harm that they commit when they commit crime, rather than just the prevalence, the number of offences that people commit. Because there are some flaws. All of these are important methods of management, but there are flaws if you merely measure prevalence. And because it's a randomised control trial, we're making quite strenuous efforts to measure the cost-benefit between the two approaches. So this is live. Bloody hell. I'll use a mouse in future. We've learnt as we've gone along, and this would be my recommendation to anybody doing one of these in future, and that is that you need to have a very structured, well-paced, staged approach to implementation. One of the biggest things that occurred to me in particular, about 3 or 4 months into this, that given that we're inventing or developing a new approach that is then being compared with an approach that is, well, is at least as old as 1361, i.e. the prosecution of offenders in a magistrate's court, that it isn't a fair comparison if you don't give the new approach that you're developing the chance to develop to the point where it is at least stable. And therefore, what we've done as we've gone along is to do it this way. First of all, we put a lot of emphasis in training ahead, and Larry's point about giving people a decent meal, we brought them here, they had a very nice meal in Queens, and we put a lot of emphasis on making those involved in the experiment feel and understand that they were important, and they are, and their involvement in the experiment was crucial to success. Only then did we switch the randomizer on and went live, and at that point we only went live for the purposes of custody sergeants, playing with it, testing it, and putting every case to prosecution for about a month and a bit. 10 cases came through deemed eligible. Actually, that gives us some data as it stands. But we were very careful to make sure that we tested the thing to destruction before we then switched to using real offenders going into Turning Point. And in that case, we switched the whole thing live only to treatment so that every offender manager had a chance to do a Turning Point case. As it turned out, that wasn't quite what happened. But nevertheless, to give every office a chance to do Turning Point cases and to give them a chance to debrief each other about the process. So we were building practice as we went and picking the bones out of it. And in stage three, which has only just started, we've now gone to full randomisation and we're expanding to Birmingham, taking the lessons, the whole of Birmingham, taking the lessons from the first two local policing areas with us. I'm going to skip through the case studies, actually. I mean, the first one I've already mentioned, which is an assault police that went through the randomizer. It was a glorious moment at the end of it where the offender came out and described it as a turning point in her life, a quote that I can assure you will be in the PhD. But the type of cases that we've got going through, Molly's just about to go through in terms of her analysis of the turning point contracts, but they are quite varied, and this one's quite a good example. CPS actually thought this guy would have got custody, I have to say. I don't know which court they're prosecuting cases in, but there's no way, as far as I can see, he'd have got custody for this. And what he's actually now got is a high-quality job as an engineer with Rover and no drugs out of Turning Point, which seems to me to be something of a result, to be frank. We'll see whether his offending continues. And just to give you a contrast, this case will go in the future, but didn't at the time. Offender with no prior conviction who goes to a drive-in McDonald's, walk on foot, and you don't tend to get served when you go on foot. Racially abused and threatened the attendant. Hate crime is currently excluded from the pilot because we're just concerned to get things right, and in particular with victims. The offender was charged, went to court, £65 fine. Actually, it was a £25 fine plus £40 costs. No apology to the victim, no compensation, etc. So that's the contrast. And now Molly is going to talk about what we found in the behavioural contracts.
So one of the important decisions that we made early on is taking this slow phased approach to introduction of this, and that has been an assessment of what's actually going on. So we've paired some qualitative work with the quantitative empirical study, and that's been really important for us to be able to go back and see, is what we think we're measuring actually what we're measuring, and also, B, to assess any sort of collateral consequences that may be going on as we do this experiment. This has been particularly important, and I think is important in general in policing experiments, because you're dealing with something that's really important. You're dealing with the harm in society, and you're dealing with a really important decision in somebody's life, prosecution or not prosecution. So it's really important that as we do this, we did not decide to go ahead and run through the experiment and then crunch all the numbers at the end and just find out what the outcome was once we've already gone through it. So we've gone through some of the numbers early on and identified some issues that we've had to address. So first of all, just looking at the types of offenses that are coming in, we do have a really good spread. This is just of the 42, I believe, adult cases that have come through so far. We do have a good spread of different types of cases coming in. So this is going to be important for us to be able to go back later and look at how this approach works given different types of offenses. There was some concern early on that we were only focusing on drug and things like that. So we've gone back and made sure that we really will be able to learn things about different types of offenses. See if I can figure this out. So in terms of the treatment plans, we've also gone back and found that offender managers are, when they're assessing a different offender's areas of need, they're doing a good job of looking at all areas of life, from sort of self-sufficiency, things like employment, to drug and alcohol problems, to restorative issues, so learning about why, helping the offender understand why what they did is wrong, and mental health issues. And we've also found that they're taking really different approaches. They've been given a lot of freedom to take a different approach, whatever approach they think is appropriate. So you see employment, I don't know how well you guys can read that, but employment has been sort of the most emphasized by offender managers. And we've had several cases where already offenders have jobs that didn't have jobs going into this program. But the qualitative piece has been really important in looking at this as well. Because going back, I've gone back and interviewed a whole bunch of victims, offenders, and the actual officers who are making the decisions. So we found that although they're putting restorative justice conferences, for example, down as one of the treatment conditions, those aren't actually happening. Only two conferences have actually gone forward, and we found that offender managers are, because they're new to restorative justice, they're interested and they're putting them down on the contract, but they're not actually following through with them for various reasons. So we've had to change our approach to integrating restorative justice into this project based on that understanding. And if we hadn't gone back and spent that time with the offender managers, we would have said, oh, these offenders are going through restorative justice. And when we went back and did the analysis, we would have counted, we looked at this to see which of these do appear to be more effective. We would have thought those people are going through restorative justice. So little things like that have been really important. In addition, going back through and crunching those numbers ahead of time at the very beginning of an experiment, just as you get going, and then also doing that qualitative piece. In crunching the numbers, we also realized that, hey, the cost-benefit numbers that we thought we were getting, we aren't actually getting, and the way that we thought that we could measure those, the offender managers aren't writing down what we thought they would write down. So we've had to change the way some of that information is gathered as well. So speaking to the turning point offenders, we've had some great results. Offenders have been talking specifically about the change that they've seen in their own lives. So from some of these quotes, you can just see the second one, somebody who got a job felt that his offense, it was an assault case, came out of a lot of problems within his family, and a lot of that just had to do with the fact that he was home and depressed all the time, and he felt like getting a job is something that's really going to help him be away from the problem and solve a lot of those problems with his family. Other offenders who've had curfews are talking about sort of identifying in their own lives, speaking about the change that they feel like has come out of this. We've also talked to some offenders who have went through the court process, and I thought this was a powerful quote about something that we think is happening, but this young person said, when I'm older, if I go to court, I won't be as scared because I've already done it. And so just this idea that what we're doing when we're sending the offenders through court is really just sort of getting them naturalized, getting them comfortable with the court environment. And as we've talked about, it may be less of a deterrent in the future if they've already sort of gotten comfortable in the court environment. So talking to the victims has also been important, as we've found that there is definitely some concern among victims that offenders who are going through this, who are not going through court, are not learning their lesson. So this has been very important because if we roll this out sort of across the board, we may find that we have some offenders, some victims who aren't too happy about what's happening. So right now, since we've done that early and we've identified that problem early, we've got a plan in place to be able to provide restorative justice to those victims so they get the opportunity to speak to the offender themselves about the impact that the crime has had, which really does seem to be their main concern. And so we'll be able to go back and compare a sample of victims after we've put this condition, this plan in place to deal with the victim issue, and compare it to right now offender or victims who have not had that experience. And so we should be able to say, okay, it may be that turning point is working better for offenders, but we may need to add restorative justice as an important integral part of that to make sure that it's working for victims as well. So the main messages that we've found is do the measurements early, do qualitative work in addition to the quantitative work, because you can get at that black box. You can see what's actually happening as opposed to what you wanted to happen or what you intended to happen. And you can fix those problems early as opposed to finding out at the end that you have issues that there's nothing you can do about. And that's it.